Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we examine the life of one of history's best-known romantic and tragic figures, Cleopatra. Susan Walker from the British Museum will be joining us to discuss the last queen of Egypt. And after that, Barbara Rosenwein, professor of history at Loyola University in Chicago, will share with us her thoughts on emotions in history. But before we hear from them, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on February 6, 1820, the first freed slaves and freeborn Americans of African descent left New York bound for Freetown in West Africa. The voyage came as a result of the efforts of the American Colonization Society. Founded in 1816, the Society sought to resolve the problem of slavery by purchasing and freeing slaves, providing them with transportation to Africa, and assisting them to establish a settlement there. It was also an attempt to reconcile the differences between supporters of the anti-slavery movement and advocates of slavery. Both groups believed that free blacks would be unable to assimilate into white society. In 1821, the American Colonization Society founded the colony of Liberia, and between 1822 and the onset of the Civil War, approximately 15,000 African Americans settled into the new colony. But the plan had many critics. Some abolitionists thought it depleted the black population of the best of the, quote, freed men, while at the same time preserving the institution of slavery. And many freedmen were reluctant to leave their homes in America for a foreign land where they had to compete with native Africans who resisted the expansion of the colony.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a relic of an era when no body was safe has been discovered in Scotland. In the wicked old days, body snatchers, they preferred to call themselves resurrectionists, did a thriving trade. In the dead of night, they slipped into churchyards, dug up newly buried corpses, and sold them to medical schools for dissection. The most famous resurrectionists were Burke and Harry Williams, who robbed graves in Edinburgh before deciding it was easier to bypass the cemeteries and simply murder likely specimens. But there were many more in the profession. 170 years later, Steve and Kate Young moved into their new home in Tettenhall. "We knew there was something at the bottom of the garden," recalled Steve, "but we had no idea what it was. It was covered in weeds and branches." The Youngs later discovered that they had purchased a 19th-century grave watcher's hut, set there to house someone to keep an eye on the nearby churchyard and protect its inhabitants. "It's quite beautiful," notes Steve, who plans on restoring and keeping the hut, with its fireplace and stained glass windows. But he couldn't resist telling an old joke in the town that harkened back to an earlier time. It seems that during a funeral procession which was making its way toward the local church, the horse that was drawing the casket broke into a trot, and the mourners had to run to keep up. One shouted, "Slow down, they'll think we stole him." This is Talking History. Perhaps no other female figure in history has received more attention than Cleopatra. She's been the subject of histories and movies, documentaries and television programs, but how much of what we've been told about the Egyptian queen is true? That's the subject of this week's conversation between Talking History's Eileen Dugan and her guest, Susan Walker.
Among the most familiar stories from ancient history is that of Cleopatra. She was the mighty Egyptian queen who conquered the hearts of Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, who sailed away from Antony in the midst of a last desperate naval battle against Rome, and then committed suicide by clutching an asp to her breast. It's such a tragic romantic tale, especially when played by Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in Gloria CinemaScope. At least that seems to be the way many imagine her today. But of all the tragic heroines from history, why have we singled out Cleopatra for such immortality? And how close are our representations of Cleopatra to the reality of her? Joining us today to explore our enduring fascination with the last queen of Egypt is Ms. Susan Walker from the Department of Greek and Roman Antiquities in London's British Museum. Ms. Walker is a co-editor of Cleopatra from History to Myth, a sumptuous catalog of the museum's recent exhibition of Cleopatra images over the last 2,000 years. Welcome, Ms. Walker.
Thank you.
How would you describe the British Museum exhibit in terms of its chronological scope and the range of the items on display?
Well, we were trying to examine the historical Cleopatra and put her into the context of relations between ancient Rome and Egypt. And then we wanted to look at how Cleopatra, as a historical figure, became a creature of myth. So in the exhibition, we had objects which ranged from the time of the early Ptolemaic rulers of Egypt, that is, the successors of Alexander the Great, one of whose generals was actually called Ptolemy and became ruler of Egypt at the end of the 4th century before Christ. And we run right the way through to modern times, to the late 20th century, because, as you rightly say, we're still very, very interested in Cleopatra. And it's fascinating to see how she's been perceived over the two millennia since her death.
What types of materials do you have on display, or did you have on display in this exhibition?
We had a very wide range of materials, including surviving statues. There are not very many surviving images of Cleopatra, but one of the most exciting features of the exhibition was that we were able to identify Egyptian-style images of her, not all of which had been recognized before. So we had quite a number of stone images of the major players, as it were, both Cleopatra and members of her family, Caesar, of course, Antony, and Octavian. We also had bronzes, mosaics, terracottas, stone reliefs, vases recently discovered in Alexandria, Cleopatra's capital city. We had also paintings and even a fan from the 19th century with a magnificent representation of Cleopatra and Antony and the suicide of Cleopatra. To my astonishment, she even shows up on watches in 18th century England, which was a great surprise. Drawings, all sorts of things. I mean, Cleopatra gets onto everything, and we wanted really to show the range of representations of this remarkable figure. Indeed, in the Chicago version of the exhibition, which went to the Field Museum from last October until March of this year, there were also costumes worn both by Liz Taylor and earlier stars of films about Cleopatra.
Who was the historical Cleopatra VII? I mean, without the myth, without the romance?
She was a very ambitious and successful queen of Egypt, a person who achieved great political power and a person with enormous charisma. And she's still regarded very positively in Egypt. It's very interesting that we have such a divide in perceptions of Cleopatra. It's quite hard to get at the real Cleopatra, but there are kernels of truth in the contemporary accounts of her. And I think it was a great help to recognize those Egyptian images. I hope we've managed to restore some kind of balance in the account of Cleopatra.
Was she really that good of a ruler, or did she achieve power just because she was good at seducing men?
She was, it does seem, irresistibly seductive. But would Caesar have left her in charge of Egypt had he not thought her competent? I don't think so.
How did her contemporaries portray her, both in writings and in artworks?
Well, in Egypt, Cleopatra was regarded as a divine ruler, and she was very closely linked to the goddess Isis. And motherhood is a very strong theme in Egyptian presentations representations of Cleopatra, both in freestanding sculpture and significantly on stone reliefs which still survive in some temples of Egypt. So motherhood is a very strong theme in these representations. And in Rome too, Cleopatra became the first living ruler to share a temple with a god. In Rome, she shared a temple with Venus the Mother, very significantly, in a new forum constructed by Julius Caesar.
Caesar, of course, being from a family that claimed to be descended from Venus.
That's right. And it's very significant, I think, that he commissioned a statue of Cleopatra, which was set up in this temple. And so that idea of Cleopatra as a divine ruler and a mother is actually carried over even to Rome. And amazingly, the statue survived for several hundred years. It seems to have been passed off by Octavian, who, of course, as you mentioned, conquered Cleopatra in 30 BCE. And after that, he seems to have passed off this statue as something that he brought back in triumph from Alexandria. It became very much associated with his victory rather than with Cleopatra's affair with Caesar, which for Octavian was, of course, a matter of some embarrassment.
We have a positive representation of Cleopatra and Caesar's statue, but how did the Romans eventually come to portray her, and how did that influence later images of her?
In the 30s BCE, after Caesar was assassinated, Cleopatra took up with Mark Antony, another Roman general of enormous stature, who was clearly very much in love with her. And Cleopatra sought to expand Egypt's influence and even managed to recover the core of the old Ptolemaic Empire with territories outside Egypt which were awarded to her by Antony. And this caused great alarm in Rome, and Octavian, who was Caesar's heir, orchestrated a great campaign against Cleopatra. Cleopatra was an enormous threat to him because she had had a son by Caesar who was co-ruler of Egypt with her. And Octavian, in contrast, although he was Caesar's heir, he was only his rather obscure great nephew. And so he tried to attack Cleopatra's relationship with Antony and portrayed her as an insatiable ruler of extraordinary greed and extravagance, whom Antony had been completely unable to resist. So she became a monster and a representation, if you like, of the other, of the un-Roman. She had made Antony unmanly and thereby un-Roman, and she was a person of enormous sexual and gluttonous appetite. And so we have a very negative image of Cleopatra, which becomes stronger and stronger in Rome in the period leading up to the Battle of Actium, which is the naval engagement in which she was defeated by Octavian. After that, it was necessary to build up a slightly more positive image of her as a powerful queen in order to make Octavian's victory seem greater than it actually was. I think at the time, though, it was perceived as a very, very significant defeat. And we've become really captives of Octavian's propaganda. This is very much the image of Cleopatra that we've inherited. And it's come down to us in a very interesting way, which I'll briefly explain. It's slightly softened in the version that we have because Shakespeare, for example, was drawing for his play, which is enormously influential in later Western European and American perceptions of Cleopatra, he was drawing on the biographies of Antony and Caesar written by Plutarch. And Plutarch was a Greek intellectual who lived about 100 years or so after these momentous events happened. And so Plutarch is writing from a Greek perspective at a time when the Romans were much more comfortable with Greeks than they were in Cleopatra's day. And so we've got a slightly softer view. We've got a view which allows room almost for Cleopatra's perspective. I mean, to a Greek, Cleopatra would have been a rather amusing and almost a sympathetic figure. So we have in Shakespeare's play something that is already there in Plutarch. We have the image of a queen who is very demanding and very, very extravagant, but who eventually comes through as an individual with enormous integrity because she committed suicide after her defeat rather than submit to Octavian. So we have someone who's a sort of symbol of Oriental despotism, but whose individual personality wins through in this tragic love affair. And it's not for nothing that Dryden called his play All for Love. And that's another perception of Cleopatra that's very important to us, that she gave up everything, even her own life, for love of Antony.
I have to ask the obligatory question. Was Cleopatra beautiful?
That's a really tricky one because the surviving images of her are really icons more than portraits, and it's very difficult to recapture any notion of what she really looked like from the surviving sculptures and coins. Ancient authors tell us that she had a very beautiful voice, and I think that's very important. We tend to underrate the voice these days. We're very obsessed with the visual image. But voices are very important in the art of seduction. And she was clearly a person of enormous charisma, the kind of person who would light up a room and you would just have been drawn to her.
Why do you think we remain intrigued by Cleopatra 2,000 years later?
Cleopatra is a very strong character, and her story has absolutely everything. It's got power politics, it's got sex, it's got romance, it's got death, and it has all the elements of the very best stories, and I really don't think that the elements of the great stories have changed very significantly over the past two millennia. And in addition, I think people still understand, though they may not remember all the details, that the defeat of Cleopatra by Octavian was something very important for our history. It just happened at a great turning point in history, and that's very significant still.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Walker.
My pleasure.
We have been talking with Ms. Susan Walker from the Department of Greek and Roman Antiquities in London's British Museum and the co-editor of Cleopatra, From History to Myth.
Once upon a time, it was believed that unrestrained emotions were antisocial, and that the history of Western civilization was a story of increasing emotional restraint. In our commentary of the week, Barbara Rosenwein, a professor of history at Loyola University in Chicago, takes issue with this historical perspective.
Let's talk about the emotions in history. In many medieval texts, emotions are often over the top. In Raoul Glaber's history, King Henry II is so angry when he besieges a city that he vows to kill all its men. But when the desperate inhabitants send out their children to beg mercy, he begins to weep and allows them to surrender peacefully. In the Song of Roland, when one knight sees another laughing at him, he has such a fit of anger, quote, that he is ready to burst. He very nearly goes out of his mind, end quote. And when Charlemagne finds his beloved Roland dead, quote, he's moved to pity, he cannot help weeping, he is so overcome with grief, he swoons over him. In Georges Chastelain's chronicles, princes are full of hatred and envy. These examples, which could be multiplied countless times, led Johann Huizinger, writing in 1919, to his famous verdict about the affective life of medieval people. They were like children in their impulsiveness and depth of feeling. Since Huizinger's day, most historians have followed his line. Why not? It's very convenient to think that medieval emotions were unrestrained because it helps bracket off that period from the modern. So, with Huizinger and his ilk at their elbows, historians have constructed a grand narrative of emotions that goes something like this. The history of the West is the history of increasing emotional restraint. The Middle Ages had the emotional life of a child, unadulterated, violent, public, and unashamed. The modern period brought with it self-discipline, control, and suppression. What's wrong with this view? Plenty. Most importantly, it's based on bad psychology. Huizinger thought that emotions were like gases under pressure, and medieval people simply didn't have the self-control to keep them tamped down. But scientists no longer think that emotions are like gases. Cognitivists and social constructionists have shown that emotions are judgments about what people consider conducive to their well-being or their harm, and that emotional expression is mediated by cultural norms. In this light, what are we to make of the over-the-top emotionality of the Middle Ages? The answer? It was a socially acceptable mode of emotional communication. But there were other modes, too, far less over-the-top, if less well-known. In fact, there were many different emotional communities in the Middle Ages. Some favored tears, others did not. Some lauded hatreds as a necessary part of honor. Others condemned hatreds as irrational. History is not a grand narrative of progress from impulsivity to restraint. It's the much more interesting story of adults, in every period, feeling their way through life.
You've been listening to Barbara Rosenwein, professor of history at Loyola University in Chicago, who is currently studying the various emotional communities of the early Middle Ages. This is Talking History. Finally, we turn to our Site of the Week segment. We call to your attention a virtual site, one you can visit from the comfort of your own home or office with the aid of your computer. The site is AdAccess, and here to review it for you is Kelly Schrum of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
In a 1929 ad for Modest Sanitary Napkins, a relatively new product, a daughter pulls her mother toward an airplane for an exciting ride, saying, "Don't be afraid, Cat Mother. There's no danger." Are you ready for television? Asked the 1944 ad in The New Yorker. The copy in this ad works to establish the medium as much as product loyalty, declaring the world stands on the threshold of an astonishing age. How did advertisers compete in an increasingly crowded market in the first half of the 20th century? What images did marketers use to advertise commercial airplanes or cosmetics? Answering these questions with traditional research would require extensive time and labor, combing through stacks of magazines and newspapers to identify relevant ads before analyzing trends. AdAccess, a website created at the Digital Scriptorium of Duke University, makes some of this research possible online by presenting more than 7,000 print ads from 1911 to 1955. This accessible archive draws on advertising clippings collected by the J. Walter Thompson Company to study competitors. AdAccess provides an excellent starting point for studying radio, television, transportation, beauty and hygiene in World War II, allowing users to investigate consumer culture virtually. To locate AdAccess, go to historymatters.gmu.edu. Type Advertising in Duke into the keyword search.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. You can learn more about the OAH and Talking History at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.